Hi there, listeners. It's Farnoosh, and I just want to say I'm really honored that you've chosen to subscribe to So Money. I know there are a lot of podcasts out there. The fact that you're here is not lost on me. Now, if you're enjoying these episodes and you're benefiting from the advice and you want more, I've actually created something really special for us. It's called the So Money Members Club. It's an online platform where you can connect more closely with me and engage with fellow So Money fans who want to become more empowered in their financial lives. The website is SoMoneyMembers.com. And when you go there, you'll learn all the benefits, including exclusive monthly finance workshops, private group calls with me. You get your questions answered in our member community. I'm often in there weighing in, and you get instant access to all of our workshop recordings. We have a robust library that's growing. So far, we've had workshops on investing in real estate, kids and money, and how to earn more in 2024. And most of all, it's fun, positive, encouraging, all the things personal finance should be. Go to SoMoneyMembers.com, and I hope you'll join us. I'm limiting enrollment, and doors will close soon. Check out SoMoneyMembers.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. So Money episode 1583. Paul Olinger, comedian, author, and host of the podcast Crazy Money.
You're listening to So Money with award-winning money guru Farnoosh Torabi. Each day, get a 30-minute dose of financial inspiration from the world's top business minds, authors, influencers, and from Farnoosh herself. Looking for ways to save on gas or double your double coupons? Sorry, you're in the wrong place. Seeking profound ways to live a richer, happier life? Welcome to So Money.
The fear that drives me to do stand-up comedy, as opposed to remaining in the corporate world where the benefits would be far more quantifiable and identifiable in the short run, the fear is that is the fear of the deathbed. You know, I don't want to ask what if on my deathbed, the metaphorical deathbed, presuming we have one to sit on for a few days or years before we, you know, take our final departure.
Welcome to So Money, everybody. I'm Farnoosh Torabi. I'm sitting down today with a So Money alumnus. Paul Olinger was on the podcast pre-pandemic. He's a writer, comedian, and podcaster, host of Crazy Money. Highly recommend. I was just on his podcast talking about the fear of money. Paul retired at 42, and he found himself bored out of his mind. How he got retired was, well, he worked at Facebook and got a nice little nest egg after they IPO'd. And that's when he decided, I need to do something different with my life, and that is to become a comedian and a speaker and a creator. Paul is the host of Crazy Money podcast, where he explores the connection between money, happiness, work, and meaning. He's had on Nobel Prize winners, Heisman Trophy winners, Olympic gold medalists, comedians, celebrities, academics. We discuss life post-pandemic. How has the comedy world, how has his material and his approach to work changed over the last few years? What happens when you become an overnight millionaire, as Paul did and many of his colleagues at Facebook, and the secret to success on social media, which I'm still figuring out. Figure it out with me on Instagram at Farnoosh Torabi. In the meantime, here's our good friend, Paul Olinger. Paul Olinger, welcome back to So Money.
Thank you, Farnoosh. It's lovely to be here.
Do you remember the last time you were on? I looked it up. It was 2019, October. We had no idea what was about to hit us.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Wow. Isn't it funny when you think about that? Like, I just reposted a picture of my son from 9 years ago, and I looked at the date, and it was the day before my mom died, and I had no idea she was going to die the next day.
Oh my gosh. So
who knows what we have in front of us right now?
Well, that's kind of where I wanted to start. You know, last time we were on, it was the before times, and we had just been introduced to one another. I was obsessed with your work. I still am. As somebody who left the corporate world, you were in Facebook, you were at Facebook in there as a sales leader, left to pursue comedy and corporate events all over the country. You've written a book. You should totally get an MBA. And I remember we talked a lot about the economics of comedy, your pivot. Your podcast, by the way, Crazy Money, is also, everybody should check it out. You incorporate so much humor in that show, but what I love is that you also tackle hard things like financial loss. And you had me on your show. We talked about financial fear. How has the pandemic in some ways reinforced / changed some of the ways that you think about your approach to the work that you do at this intersection of money and levity?
Well, as a comedian, the pandemic was not good. I was in 2019, I headlined Caroline's on Broadway, West Side Comedy Club in New York City. I had a meeting set with the New York Comedy Festival on March 17th, 2020. So things were really headed in the right direction. And then everything stops for a year and change. And, you know, comedy is all about momentum. Entertainment's about momentum. And so I lost a good deal of momentum. And I did spend a lot of time working on the podcast during the pandemic. But now that it's back, you've got to kind of rebuild things brick by brick inside the comedy world. I think in general, you know, we're still talking about people going back to work. And we're 3.5 years past when the pandemic started. So clearly, the way we consider work as a part of our lives has been changed, maybe permanently. And I think generationally, certainly, the pandemic has changed the way Gen Z relates to work much differently than Gen X, my generation, did. So maybe a good reminder that nothing is permanent in this world, and that we should embrace every day, and that we should try to set ourselves up for a life where when we wake up in the morning, we're excited about what that day holds for us.
Were there silver linings for you between 2020 and 2022, I suppose? I hear a lot from those who were in the entertainment field, the creative space, where, and even now with the strike, I think that you're hearing about this, a lot of the folks in that have been affected, like, I need to make my own stuff. I need to become more accountable for my own paychecks. How are some of the hard lefts or the hard rights that you took in those years turned out to be the MO now for you, because you kind of liked it, or it worked out?
You know, I think it's not like that things are good or bad in terms of the way the entertainment business works now. It just is what it is. And I'm not commenting on the writer's strike and the power of the streaming services or anything like that. That's not what I do. Not really. But I mean, in terms of the production of television shows, but what's clearly different today than it was as we were going into pandemic is that the most important influencer, the most important gatekeeper in the comedy business is the algorithm. It's not the person who books The Tonight Show. Michael Cox, I love you, but the algorithm is more important than you are. It's not the person who books any one club or any chain of clubs. It's the algorithm. Because if you can amass a following on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook, you can put butts in seats for live events. And if you can put butts in seats for live events, you control your future. If you're depending on the clubs to introduce you to an audience, you'd have to work for 50 years to try to make that happen. So today, and the, you know, even though I worked at Facebook, creating content for social media isn't really intuitive to me. And the people who have figured it out, the people who have said, you know, I'm going to do my dances on TikTok, or I'm going to create content for TikTok or for Instagram. They've in many cases have been well rewarded. There's a woman I had on Crazy Money a few months back named Leah Rudick.
And oh, I know Leah. She came on my Leah? Show.
Oh, she did?
I fell in love with her comedy. I was just a...
That's easy to do. That's easy
number.
To do.
Yeah.
She's so funny. She's such a... She's beautiful and she's crazy and she does these characters.
Yes.
And you look at these characters and their characters are so creepy. You're like, how is this person doing that character? But yeah. She does the wealthy woman character.
I love that one. Yeah.
And it's so funny that she's created this character who's a woman who's so wealthy. She has... she's totally clueless about how the world works. And so wealthy woman goes to Waffle House, wealthy woman goes to IHOP or whatever.
Yeah.
They're so funny. And so she's put together 500,000 followers on Instagram and on TikTok. She's selling out clubs all over the country because she's used the platform, and she used the platform during pandemic to create an audience for herself, a following.
Wow.
Perfect example of someone who created their own opportunity. For somebody who's 54 years old like me, I'm still figuring it out because these are not the platforms on which I want there to be, Farnoosh. I want there to be an email based social media network. I want a place where I can send
phone
you an
directory.
Email. That's right. And we can use bullet points and italics, well formatted, well reasoned, well written emails, and the best email gets 500,000 followers. That's my kind of social media network.
I really hear you. And the challenge with the algorithm is that it changes all the time.
It
and
does.
I don't want to be dancing on TikTok. I have integrity.
Well, you know, I've...
I like money too, though. And so there's where the conflict sits.
I feel that you have to figure out the way to tickle the algorithm, mm-hmm. you know? And unfortunately, well-reasoned conversations between intelligent people doesn't get a lot of play. It doesn't get a lot of play on television either, right? I mean, right. That's the forum of public media or public radio and podcasting. And yet that doesn't, you know, we don't tickle the algorithm. And as a buddy of mine put it to me, he's like, you can hate the game, but it's the game that's being played. Mm-hmm. And you can either play it or not play it. And if you don't play it, you're not going to get any, you're not going to build a following. So, you know, congratulations on falling on your intellectual sword, but this is where the game is. Yeah. And you can, the way I kind of think about it is, hey, look, this is a new canvas, and we all need to learn how to paint on this canvas. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean you have to do what everybody else is doing. It means you have to find a way to be you, how to use this platform authentically in a way that doesn't make you want to quit. Mm-hmm.
Last we spoke, though, you were talking about how you're cornering the corporate speaking market, which not a
yes,
lot of
cornering
comedians
it. Cor-
do.
Like the Hunt brothers cornered the silver market, Farnoosh.
But I want to talk yourself up a little bit. I think you're doing great. I love your podcast. Again, Leah's doing it her way. She's a wealthy woman on TikTok. That's not what you're going to do. But tell us what you are doing.
Well, I'm doing the podcast, which I can't stop doing it. I can't quit the podcast. I probably, you know, like my problem is I have two brands. I have like the podcast brand, which is the money brand. Then I have the comedian brand. And I'm trying to figure out a way to bring those two things together because they're not terribly complementary. I do a decent bit of public speaking. I spoke at Coca-Cola about how perfectionism has kind of led me down the wrong path in life and how embracing the imperfect is actually a very positive thing. I've spoken to the Young Presidents Organization several times about, what's next, how to find meaning in life after you hit that number that you have been working toward for all these years. Because the process, what really led me to start Crazy Money was working at Facebook and being very fortunate and getting, you know, stock early and being able to have all of a sudden immense financial freedom in my early 40s. And because I did that, I quit my job and I sort of just sat around for a year. I mean, I had a great time up to a point. Then I realized, wait a minute, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm supposed to do today. We need work. We need purpose. We need meaning. But you don't know that until you actually have the opportunity to not work. And then you go look back and you go, you know, there's a lot of good stuff about work. I liked my colleagues for the most part, you know, mm-hmm. we sometimes fought, but you know, I liked my colleagues. I liked being a guy in a network, in an industry and where I had built up 15 years of credibility and skill and knowledge. That was a good thing. And you don't realize what you're getting from work besides a paycheck until you quit and you don't have the belongingness and the self-esteem, to pull words off of Maslow's hierarchy, that work provides you. And so that's kind of the insight that I want to explore. That's what led me to start exploring the connection between money, happiness, and meaning on Crazy Money. And I've almost 200 episodes now, which is nothing compared to you, I know, but I'm trying to do 40 episodes a year. And I've talked to everybody from LL Cool J to Judd Apatow to, it looks very likely that I'm going to interview Ed Begley Jr. next week. I've talked to really, really fun, interesting people that I never would have gotten to meet if not for the podcast.
What's your pitch when you reach it? Because I want to get some more big names on this show. And
we can help each other. We can refer each other. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll often go to NetGalley to see who's got a book coming out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a great source to understand who might be open to talking, because, you know, most people want to pitch a book. Sometimes they're like, look, the author's doing five podcasts and it's, you know, the five biggest ones, right? So I'm not going to get a shot.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's this sort of second wave after a book has been published, like 3 months down the line. They're like, why isn't this thing selling? I need to do more podcasts. That's where I swoop in. And they're like, you've never heard of me, but here's who I've talked to. And the pitch is basically, I'll read your book, number one, which most people, you know, most interviewers don't really understand the book of the person they're talking to. And so we'll have an intelligent, informed conversation. Two, look at all the other people that I've spoken to. And I was very fortunate to have Dr. Drew and Ron Lieber from the New York Times in my first four episodes. So I built good credibility. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, that means that, hey, people of a certain level of respectability are showing up and Paul's not a complete moron. So why not take a chance and have a conversation with him?
I personally had a great time on your podcast, and thank you for reading my book, which is not a small feat, especially I think you're read it in a pretty quick period of time.
I enjoyed getting to know you. I liked learning about your childhood. I think about little Farnoosh and what it must have been like.
Well, who was little Paul? I want to know. And I also want to know, because you do one of the scariest things, which is you get on a stage and you give talks and you perform comedy. And later I want to ask about how you harness fear in your career. But what was I don't know if we got into this on the first podcast we did now four years ago. We didn't talk about little Paul. What were Paul's hopes and dreams, Paulie?
Yeah. These two things are totally related. And, you know, most comics are either, you know, trying to make up for or run away from their childhoods. I had a very good childhood, but it was a little bit crazy. I was one of six kids in a big Catholic family in suburban Atlanta. And I'm still tight with my brothers and sisters. My parents stayed together for 55 years until my mom died 9 years ago, 3 days ago. And so, there were always a lot of people in the house. It was crazy, a lot of activity. And I think I was the fifth. And so I think I always wanted more attention. I joke that my parents never took pictures of me except for insurance documentation purposes.
Passport.
Passport? Are you kidding me? I never left the country until I was like 16 or 17, which is still reasonably early, I guess. But it's in contrast to what my son's going to camp in Iceland next summer. And I'm like,
whoa.
I flew to St. Louis one way on Eastern Airlines in seventh grade. These kids are having a great, they're traveling all over the world. But we were a pretty tight family. We all played sports. None of us, you know, were amazing athletes or anything, but I think the desire to stand out at the dinner table and get airtime at the dinner table was sort of a defining experience of my life. And I did plays in high school, but I went to college thinking, you know, I'm going to college to get a good job, because if I get a good job, then there'll be financial stability. And we had everything, but my parents are Depression era people. And they were Depression era people. And so money was always tight. It always felt like money was tight in our house. And so I thought, well, if I get a good job and I make enough money, then I'll never worry about money, which is a hilarious myth, by the way, because you can make a ton of money and still be worried about it. You make a ton of money and still be broke, as I'm sure you talk about on your show a lot. Mm-hmm. and you can make a lot of money and still fight with your spouse about money. And that's one of those things that people think, hey, I'm going to make some money, so all my problems will go away. No, it's just different problems, right? Mm-hmm. And so I went to business school because I wanted to make more money. And I told jokes at a talent show there one night. And that's when I got bit by the comedy bug. And ironically, I found out I wanted to do comedy at a, you know, fancy business school. And so, but I had loans. I had $80,000 in loans in 1997. So I was like, well, I got to go get a job and pay these off, because that's what people used to do, is pay off their student loans. And so I went into the digital media industry and eventually kind of wove back and forth between comedy and digital media until 9 years ago when I started comedy full time.
And you all can listen to that link, listen to that episode of Paul and I talking about his beginnings. And oh, you said something interesting, which is that, you know, when you kind of cashed in on your Facebook stock, you had sort of this, you know, fun year, but then kind of like an existential moment where of like, what is this all for? What am I mm-hmm. doing? What were your colleagues like? Like, if you had to categorize, like, there were three types of people when they became overnight rich. You know, there was the person who blew it all, there was the person who had an existential crisis, and there was a person who pretended like they were still poor. You know, I don't know, mm-hmm. but what, if have you thought about that? Have you reflected on that? What, from as far as like your former colleagues, like, where is everybody now since that big cash in?
I think everybody's doing different things. A lot that informs this is, one, I was on the business side of Facebook, so I didn't know a whole bunch of the engineers who tended to be younger also, which I think, I mean, I was 42 was relatively old at Facebook back then. Today it's a, you know, much different company. The founders are almost right. 20 years older, and there's a broader selection of people there because it's, I don't know, 30 or 40,000 people. I can't remember what the net of the layoffs is, but you know, some people are still working. Some people retired. Some people changed industries and are doing something completely different, like me, I guess. And there are ways that we communicate to say, hey, how have you navigated this or that? But there's also a broad spectrum of outcomes. You know, some people made a couple million bucks. Some people made a couple hundred million bucks.
Wow.
Very, very different outcomes. And so there's just I moved from Los Angeles to Atlanta. Rich in Atlanta is very different than rich in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's just kind of doing their best to navigate what life looks like on the other side of a windfall.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
For the longest time, I dreaded buying bras. It was like shopping for jeans. Impossible. You want a bra that's sexy? You want a bra that's comfortable? You can't have both. Well, now you can, thanks to Third Love. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, the ick, the ugh, out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem or brablem. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school. Get smoothing, you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made with premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with the code PODCAST15. Did you know that I'm a podcast host and also a mind reader? Because I know that you want to grow your portfolio, to deal with the rising costs of inflation, to pay off your debt or your mortgage. You want to attack pretty much anything standing in the way of you and your financial freedom, right? Well, here's one solution: more knowledge. This podcast helps, I hope. And you can use Yahoo Finance, where you can get access to the news, data, and tools that you need to help reach your definition of financial freedom. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. They're the number one finance destination, and I know because I worked there for many years, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, customizable charts, so much more. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com. The weather's getting warmer as I record. It's a nice 73 degrees on the East Coast. So finally, time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and, fingers crossed, hello to shorts and tees. And I need to update my wardrobe for the long haul. And, you know, I don't want to spend a fortune. So luckily, I found Quince. I'm honest. I've got a lineup of timeless pieces from Quince that keep me looking effortlessly chic year after year. I'm talking premium European linen dresses, blouses and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless 14 karat gold jewelry, and tons more. Best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. I have t-shirts from Quince, pajamas from Quince. My very chic and fashionable sister-in-law, Hannah, her whole closet is Quince. And people often stop us and ask, where did you get this? Don't tell me the price. And then when I do, they're shopping on Quince.com. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to Quince.com/sewmoney for free shipping on your order and 365 day returns. That's Quince.com/sewmoney to get free shipping and 365 day returns. Quince.com/sewmoney. I'll never forget reading, it was in New York Magazine, a woman anonymously had written about how she had, it was during the pandemic, a lot of tech companies were thriving, booming, IPOing, and she earned $9 million, I think. She was like employee 11 or something, and she felt so gross, weirdly. I thought it was weird. She said, well, you know, I'm suddenly this rich person, and it's so weird. My parents are kind of uncomfortable because I'm richer than them now. And it kind of just really unveiled so much of her childhood trauma around, you know, her relationship with her parents. And
right.
She wanted to give it back. And I was like,
well, I think that's
can
one
you
of
call
the
inst- me, please? I don't yeah. think this is.
That's one of the instincts, though. That's in the, and, it, you know, that's not a healthy instinct. A healthy instinct would be, okay, I have this thing. What does it mean to me? And how do I use it to help me live the best life possible? Mm-hmm. Now that might mean giving a certain percentage, even a meaningful percentage, maybe half of it away to causes that you really care about. But I think people, I have had experiences where you think that philanthropy is just writing a check. And that when you write that check, somehow it's going to make you feel fulfilled. And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. And when you get involved with organizations, you think, well, this organization's doing the work in the world that needs to be done. And then you get involved with them, you go, maybe it's actually not doing what I thought it was doing. And maybe giving away my money isn't going to be as soul cleansing as I may have thought it was going to be. And so... We took a much more methodical approach to it and started to say, hey, you know, this money needs to last. If I'm going to be in the creative business, we need to act as if there's no more money coming in. And so, for example, our philanthropic budget is the same as the other budgets. No matter where it goes, if it goes out the door, it's not coming back. So how do we plan our philanthropic expenses, you know, over 25 years in the same way we think about housing and education and all that kind of stuff. So the experience of making a meaningful amount of money isn't what people think it's going to be. And it doesn't make your life perfect. It doesn't make you perfect. In some ways, it heightens your fears and insecurities and your bad habits. And if you let it, it can strengthen those things. It can make you more purposeful. It can make you more mindful. It can make you ask the questions that maybe if you're just working if the paycheck's coming in and things are pretty good, you're not stopping to say, what are we doing with this money? And is it really going where we want it to go?
Right.
Because if you're wise, when you start making this money, you know that you got to sit down, you got to make your estate, you got to put your estate documents together, you got to put your trust together so that you don't end up giving your kids millions of dollars when they're 18 years old. And you have to say, well, what do we really want? What's the purpose? What's the idea? How can we best use these funds to live the life we want to live, but also to help other people maybe change the trajectory of their life?
It's that healthy panic that I love to talk about. But how have you harnessed fear, whether it's in your career, in your financial life? I don't know if you had any of these sort of fears that you talk about related to the windfall, but I'm just curious. I'm kind of throwing back your interview with me to you. You asked me a lot about my fears. I want to know about your fears and maybe the good ones that have helped you.
I think the fear that drives me to do stand-up comedy, as opposed to remaining in the corporate world where the benefits would be far more quantifiable and identifiable in the short run. The fear is the fear of the deathbed. You know, I don't want to ask what if on my deathbed, the metaphorical deathbed, mm-hmm. presuming we have one to sit on for a few days or years before we, you know, take our final departure. My thing was, I know I love making people laugh on a level, on a deep, deep level. And once you're bit by the comedy bug, you don't, or whatever bug it is, you know, whether it's writing or cooking or any kind of artistic thing or helping other people, whatever that thing is that puts its claws into you, it's probably not going to let go. Now, there might be different ways to satisfy the Jones that it creates in you. And public speaking is not quite as fun as stand up, but it's still pretty darn fun. It pays a lot better.
In the beginning,
I had a pretty good I had a pretty nice corporate gig last night, but there's just something visceral about comedy, that live connection between you and other people in live events. And I want to talk about live events before we get off. There was an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal about how much people are spending on live events and concerts and stuff like that. But yeah, to finish the answer on fear, like I didn't want to be on my deathbed to think, what would my life have been like if I had actually honored that feeling, that authentic drive inside me to say, this is a direction you should walk. And if I didn't walk down that path and instead went the other safe path, what Stephen Pressfield in The War of Art calls shadow careers. Even if I were a talent manager or owned a comedy club, I was close to it, but I wasn't really doing that thing. I didn't want to think, gosh, what could have happened if I'd followed that all the way down? And so that's what I do. And it's fun and it's great. And I wake up, we might've talked about the laptop test or what you can call the phone test. But when you wake up in the morning, you look at your phone, are you excited about what you're going to see when you open it? Or are you dreading what you're going to see? And if you're excited about it, if you're interested, if you're curious, it's a way better way to wake up in the morning.
Ah, you're making me think. I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel like I've.
What would you rather do than what you're doing?
I love what I do, but I think that with this book and everything, I want to take the book Healthy State of Panic and find some adaptations of it. Maybe there's a play. Maybe there is a series on TV. I don't know. I feel like wanting to pursue more things in the entertainment world, but no, I want to have agency. I want to have control because I see how it can be just so destructive and like so silly sometimes trying to like wait for them to decide. I mean, I've done a lot of television. I know how that world operates and it's not for the faint of heart. And I think like, I feel now that I have some foundation, I have some savings, I have a body of work.
You have a non-trivial platform. Mm. So here's maybe the good part of social media that is that you can use your social media as a pilot, right? You can go and you know what? Farnoosh's fear index or whatever it is. It's like the openness of the tower. By the way, one of my favorite interviews was with Barry Schwartz, the author of The Paradox of Choice, meaning, you know, the more choice you have, the more petrified we are about making an actual choice.
Right.
Right. And so that's one of the scary things about social media is it's a blank canvas and you can do anything. as long as it's in a vertical oriented format, right? So, which is another whole thing, but like,
16 you know, you by can nine.
You can do whatever you want in this format and you can test any idea you want and you'll get immediate feedback as to what resonates and doesn't. And if you, you know, stumble on to like what Leah Rudick stumbled on, you know, that's how you go to NBC or, you know, fill in the name of network and you determine the nature of the relationship because you've proven that there's an audience for this stuff. Not that it's easy to figure out, but that's kind of the, you know.
Well, it takes the middleman out. You don't have to wait for the executives to call you, which was sort of the 1990s way of doing things and even maybe 5 years ago still. But now
why won't Scott Sassa return my phone call?
Right. But just to one more example of that, and then we'll go to the live event stuff. But, you know, Zarna Garg is another comedian. I don't know if she's been on your podcast, but she's a woman who in the pandemic really took off because she went on TikTok and started doing comedy. Prior to that, stay-at-home mom. Prior to that, a lawyer. And always, again, was that funny woman in her family. And she and I were, she's been on the show. We've become friends. And she's like, you know, this whole writer strike has made it like everyone's afraid because for her, she had some deals on the table. She had some adaptations. She had a Netflix show, potentially all the things that went kind of dark because of the writer strike and the Hollywood strike. And so she said, you know, at my job right now, what this fear is telling me is like, I got to continue to stay relevant. And the only way I can do that is just keep doing what I'm doing on my existing platforms. If I want a sitcom down the road, well, I basically need to start doing that on my Instagram.
Totally. And she has, 100%.
And you see her family all the time. It's like reality TV on her Instagram. And I have to give her a lot of credit because it is, by the way, a lot of work.
It's a full-time job.
Constantly. It's two full-time jobs. So it looks easy. Y'all make it look very easy, but we know behind the scenes, it is a lot of late nights and early mornings.
There's a lot of work. I mean, you could, as we were kind of chatting before we started recording, you could spend, there's no limit to how much you could spend on production and editing and stuff for both podcasts and production of videos on Instagram. And it's almost like the people who spend the most get the worst results because the stuff that really seems to resonate is just people talking into their phones and somehow conveying what their life is like or what's going on inside their heads. I mean, Leah's as successful as anybody I've met doing it. And her productions are not super high value. They're just really authentic and hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like people who first focus on the website before they actually work on the business plan or the...
What's that called? There's a concept to that. What
window is... dressing? I don't know.
No, there's a... What book is it? They're talking about... teaching a monkey to juggle stools or something. And he's like, if that's your goal and you start building the stool first, you're getting it completely backwards because anybody can build a stool, but nobody can, you know, teach a monkey to juggle or whatever this concept to say, like, you think you're making progress, but you're not because you're focused on the non essential part of the transaction. And so, yeah. So don't spend too much time worrying about the grand production. Right. Just make something that's authentic and funny. Mm-hmm. Just start talking into the camera.
I'm happy to hear live events are back. And I think we have Taylor Swift to thank for that. I don't know. I think although I was just listening today to, I think it was yesterday on NPR, they were talking about, was a culture editor, and he was talking about the Taylor Swift halo effect on all sorts of live events. It's why, for example, people are, you know, not why, but there's just an enthusiasm to get out. And that's also post-pandemic life. I think people just want to get out of their homes. What are you seeing on that front? I think it's exciting. I think the more we can get away from algorithms and just get people gathered that's my speed.
Well, I think that's why comedy is really experiencing a resurgence. Like it was already pushing forward, probably fueled by social media and people discovering comics they like through Instagram and TikTok. And then the pandemic happened, everything shut down, but it's come back so strong. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning about the degree to which it's back. And they mentioned that there's something like five or six acts that have grossed more than 100 million or multiple hundred millions in tour revenue in a year. And it was like Elton John, Bruce Springsteen, Taylor Swift, of course, being the queen of all of them, and maybe Beyonce. And it was like people are getting – the scary part about it, Farnoosh, is that people are borrowing money to go to these events. There was another article a couple weeks back. I can't remember what it was in. But it was about this guy. It was about housing prices, and about that people can't afford houses with the interest rates now. And so this one guy said, well, I know I'll never be able to afford a house. That's why I just spent $1,600 on Taylor Swift tickets. And it's like, oh, dude, you're going to be poor forever. So it's sort of like it's both exciting and understandable, kind of like travel, the travel boom as well. But it's scary because people have this sort of like, eat, drink, and be merry.
It's a defeatist attitude. So it's psychological. You think like, well, I already have $1,000 in debt, in credit card debt. What's another $50 sweater? You know, the minimum's only going to go up by 18 right. cents. And yeah, I had the same thought when I would see headlines like Taylor Swift boosting the economy. I'm like, yeah, but the tickets are $3,000 and you're in the nosebleed section. Those people... not everybody's paying cash. I'm going to venture to guess that those people are not all paying cash, and that the next leg of this story is going to look a lot darker and grimmer. And it was like within a month, it was like America's credit card bills have toppled whatever it was. We've reached a record. And part of that is where interest rates are. But I think it's also this irrational spending, a lot of factors fueling it.
You know, people, I do generally talk about people at the higher end of the spectrum on my show, because that's been my personal story. And that's what I always wanted. And that's the American dream, to get rich. But the first part of getting rich is achieving solvency. And, you know, the richest I've ever felt in my life was the day I paid off my student loans. Mm-hmm. There is zero is the greatest number you can get to. It gives you a foundation for financial autonomy and self-determination. And that's what I wish for everybody in this country, is to feel that like I'm in charge of my own finances. I can achieve what I set out to achieve. And I don't need this bullshit, you know, that this bling, and I don't need, I can take my daughter to the Taylor Swift concert movie. She doesn't have to go to the concert, and she's going to learn a lesson. I'm going to empower her to make the right kind of financial decisions by showing her that there's trade-offs in life, and that sometimes you don't get what you want. And I'm sorry, America, but that's part of life. You know, be a grown-up. Accept the fact that some people have more than you do, and a lot of people have a lot less than you do, but you don't think about them all the time, do you?
My grandmother used to always say, well, because, you know, the expression in our culture is there's always another level. So you're just always like hamster on a wheel. My grandmother would say there's always a basement. Always a lower level. Never forget where you are in relation to others.
That's the lesson you learn when you make money. Like, so I got to a place at Facebook where I made more money than I ever dreamed of. And I was like, what else could I possibly want? And then I started hanging out with other people who had this much money. And you know what they have? They have jets. They don't have just one home. They have three homes. They, you know, they don't belong to one country club. They belong to three country clubs. And it's like, oh, you know, it's basically like you got to get to a point where you go, I have what I need, and I'm living the life that where I can wake up and like what I do every day. And that's wealth. And to some degree, it's a choice to not keep chasing that next level, because if you're chasing the next level, you're going to be doing it forever, and it doesn't stop.
Well, Paul Ollinger, looking forward to having you back. Let's not wait another 4 years, and let's please not have another pandemic in between. I appreciate you so much. Your bio, by the way, comedian, podcaster, speaker, that's something to aspire to. I think I want it in that hierarchical order someday too. Maybe I'll squeeze in author as like the second title, but everybody check out Paul. He is the host of Crazy Money. You must subscribe. I hope to see you in person live.
Are you in New York?
I'm right outside Montclair, New Jersey.
I shall be in New York again soon, so we can make that happen.
All right, let's do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Paul for joining us. To check out his upcoming shows and learn more about his work, visit paulollinger.com. And he is on Instagram at paul_Ollinger. I'll put those links. And if you like this show, please hit that subscribe button. Please leave a review in Apple Podcasts. I pick a reviewer every week to get a free 15-minute money session with me. This is worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And you can get it for free. Just leave a review. I pick one out of the hat every Friday. It could be you. We could be on the phone pretty soon. I'll see you back here on Friday for Ask Farnoosh. So get those reviews in. In the meantime, I hope your day is so money. Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.